Support your curiosity by becoming a member of KCRW. That way you can help ensure KCRW music, news, and culture will continue to thrive and fulfill your need to know. Donate at kcrw.com/join.
On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine, and this is The Spinoff. Joining me on the podcast, as always, is Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. He joins us from Vegas. Vegas Joe, welcome back.
Hey, Mike, happy 2016 to you.
Happy 2016. And we're also happy to welcome Diane Gordon back to The Spinoff. Diane created The Surf Report and contributes to Vulture and Variety and TVInsider.com, among other places. She's been at the TCA, in the TCA Television Critics Association Press Tour Trenches with me the past, what, year? Decade?
I've lost all track.
Held hostage at the Langham Huntington Hotel. I have no idea. But we're lucky enough to pull her away for a bit as well. Hello, Diane. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure to spend some time with Mikey and Mojo.
Exactly. Well, as Joe mentioned, 2016, everybody. It's an election year. It's an Olympics year. Football's back in Los Angeles.
It's all happening.
It's a whole new year, a whole new life. TV is changing as well. And that's been one of the hot topics of the winter TCA gathering, the Television Critics Association Confab, where everyone gathers twice a year, press and networks alike, to talk about what's coming up on television, what's changing in the business. And these days, because so much is changing in the business, it leads to some really interesting conversations and a lot of news as well. So we're going to touch on that on this episode of The Spinoff. Joe, you couldn't make it out for this one, but you're here in spirit, right? Joe, you're
actually,
on. You're
no,
on.
I've actually made sure my spirit has stayed away. People start the year with a cleanse, like, you know, these cleanses in Hollywood. It's like, I'm going to do a TCA cleanse and just and sort of get ready. I'll be back in July probably, but just sort of like, you know, yeah, I'm such a grumpy grump. I admire all the tweets and stories coming out of TCA, but I'm sort of like, yes, fine, I'll be there in spirit.
You are here in spirit, and of course, you're on top of everything that's being discussed at the TCA anyway. So if anything, you don't need the TCA, Joe. Oh, you're a one man.
I'm post TCA, exactly. Yes.
Exactly.
I'm like, you know, the Donald Trump of TCA. It's like, I don't need the party infrastructure. What? Okay, let's stop.
All right. Well, in danger of being hashtag peak TCA, we can kick things off by discussing sort of some of the things that have been coming out of the TV Critics Association Confab. It's the time of year where people in the industry, everyone from talent to showrunners, like I mentioned, to network executives, they get up on stage, they make themselves available to answer questions from the press.
Or answer
in a way that really is not an answer. So it's sort of all the above. But there have been some interesting topics that have emerged.
Topics
that are sort of perennials, such as diversity, both in front of the camera and behind the camera. Donald Trump has reared his head quite a few times. The ghost of Donald Trump has been felt at TCA. But, you know, kicking things off for Diane, what sort of has struck you as maybe sort of the through line this TCA?
I think there's been continued references about the presence of women both in front of and behind the camera. And I got to give a shout out to the CW because they did a showrunner panel with Jenny Snyder Ehrman and Aileen Brash McKenna, the two showrunners of Jane the Virgin and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, respectively. And then it was followed by the 100 panel, which had five of the actresses from the show. And it did my heart good just to see these smart and talented women kind of knock it out of the park at TCA. And you could just feel the energy in the room. It was a different energy than what you usually feel. And I ran into Mark Pedowitz, the head of the network, after the sessions. And, you know, I told him that. And he just beamed. So, cheers to the CW. Just Yeah, that is great to see at Press Tour.
Well, the CW is having a good week, actually. Their star Rachel Bloom of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend picked up an award at the Golden Globes for Outstanding Actress in a Comedy. A second year in a row that CW has won that. They've been snubbed by the Emmys for years, but they're having a good week.
And I believe she's also like the first YouTube star to win a Golden Globe.
The Globes have always loved whatever network the CW is at any given time. I mean, we'll remember that back when the CW was the WB, which is sort of its ancestral roots and its origin story. Felicity was a show that won a Golden Globe, most famously, right, Mike?
Exactly.
It's the Globes. Yeah, we could have a whole discussion on the Globes, but it's certainly good. You know, the Globes get a lot of justified criticism and scorn and derision because they're insane. It's 90 people making weird votes, but it's really good to see them at least shine a spotlight on interesting choices. Because, you know, if I don't think awards are good for much, but if they're good for sort of exposing shows that people might not normally hear about, and that'd be great. But, you know, what was interesting to me about that, though, guys, and if we can talk about TCA and this come up, is that, unfortunately, you can't watch all of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend Season 1 on any streaming platforms because of the rights issues. So it's sort of frustrating there.
Yeah, yeah. Luckily, that's starting to change. You're starting to see more stacking than you used to on VOD. We're just kind of jumping all over the place with topics, but, you know, TCA is kind
TCA
of like
brand.
That. So, but you are starting to see a little more stacking. The networks are trying harder. But yeah, you're right. Rights issues are still an issue, especially for, you know, some shows and some networks. Another topic coming out of TCA that I mentioned that we should bring up because, again, it's sort of a weird parallel between TV and film. And the Oscar nominations just came out. And, you know, there's huge discussion now where, once again, every nominee on the Oscars is white. There's
hashtag
no diversity
Oscar's
at all.
So white.
Yeah. So and compare that to television, where television continues to make some really great strides with diversity. It's a hot topic. TV's not perfect. CBS's new president, Glenn Geller, had to answer some tough questions about why they seem to be lagging a little behind at CBS. But when you look at the networks, for the most part, you know, representation, particularly on ABC and some of the other networks that are really advancing, the networks are continuing to make some really decent strides in diversity.
Definitely. And, you know, hearing Eva Longoria yesterday talking about her experience making telenovela for NBC. And then again, you know, this wonderful sort of multi-culti panel at the CW for the 100. There's just lots of different types of people. And it's reflecting what the world looks like, which is exactly what TV and features should be doing, ideally.
Yeah. And another hot topic, you know, Joe, jump in here because I know you've been following the campaigns and the election so far closely and the early stages of the presidential race. And of course, Donald Trump, the ghost of Donald Trump is all over TCA, particularly during the NBC day, of course, because there's some real questions about, you know, NBC having severed business ties with Donald Trump last year. You know, he was let go as the host of Celebrity Apprentice. And then, of course, they ended their financial agreement over the Miss Universe pageant. You know, they returned their portion back to Trump, who then immediately flipped the pageant and sold it to WME-IMG. But there were some real questions about why then NBC ended up allowing Donald Trump to host SNL, why he's been all over. And you know, NBC had some real, you know, defense of that, which is, well, that's different. That's not a business relationship. That's just, you know, him on camera. And of course, you're going to have the Republican front runner host SNL.
But they were careful to point out he was only in 11 minutes of the show.
Yeah. But Joe, what do you make of the continued air of Trump sort of dominating everything, including discussion of television?
You know, it means that Donald Trump gets ratings, quite frankly, and networks are addicted to ratings and they're addicted to buzz and attention. You know, it's amazing to me when you watch the Sunday morning shows now, they've all sort of given up on the idea of having guests in studio, because Donald Trump just wants to phone it in, literally phone it in. and so you see, you know, it's a weekly Trump report. MSNBC will carry portions of Trump speeches live on their, progressive-leaning shows because it's almost like hate watching, and the commentators will then come on and sort of attack it. And it's honestly it is all sort of a sad day for democracy, because here's the thing: I don't. there's nothing wrong, I guess, with – I mean, there is something wrong on one level with SNL giving a venue to Donald Trump, and yet he is a legitimate candidate for president who allegedly, according to polls – and we'll see how those bear out when people actually start voting a front runner, you can't necessarily fault them for making a craven decision like that, right?
Right, right.
I mean, I can fault them because it was just a horrible show. It wasn't very funny. The thing is, it's Trumpism has taken over because it's loud and bombastic and gets ratings, and it's simple. And it's a combination of seeing the massive cuts that have happened to network news infrastructures and cable news. They don't actually have the staff anymore to actually do reporting or investigation. They only have the staff to cover video and talk endlessly. And Donald Trump gives people plenty to talk about. He knows how to play the ratings game. He's been playing it for 20 years, and he's putting on a great show for our democracy. It's unfortunate, but it's what's happening. And it's, it's probably only going to continue until he starts losing.
And that was the point that Bob Greenblatt, the head of NBC, made, which is you can't ignore the fact that he is a front runner and he is a legitimate candidate. You might not like his politics, but as Greenblatt said, if we kept anyone off the air who we disagreed with, then we'd be out of business. You can't put anyone on at that point. So another hot topic at this TCA, and this is, sort of goes a little deeper into the business, the future of cable. There's been a lot of discussion, of course, heading out of last year when, of course, FX put out its press release touting 409 scripted series across streaming, broadcast, and cable last year. And there's, of course, the big question of have we reached peak TV? Is there a bubble? But sort of the variation on that is with the changing way people subscribe to cable and sort of watch television, the ongoing debate over whether or not people are cutting the cord. David Nevins from Showtime actually brought up a new topic, which is cord cobblers. So you now have cord cutters, people who are just completely cutting off cable. Then you have cord cobblers who sort of put together sort of an ad hoc selection of Hulu and Netflix and maybe a skinny bundle on their cable. And maybe they've got an antenna. They're sort of cobbling together their programming choices. And then, of course, there's the cord nevers, the people who just aren't buying anything ever. But what's interesting is there's a real discussion now on going forward in the next couple of years as people turn more towards skinny bundles, especially as they start to buy internet services. And maybe you buy internet TV that has an AMC and FX, but not a ton of channels. When does that sort of become critical mass, and when does that change the conversation, and what does that do to certain cable networks, and what does that do to the whole notion of peak TV?
I think this has been talked about for a while, and I think it's more like these really, really tiny niche cable channels like Ovation, like they're the ones that are in the most danger of just fading away. But I think these things reach critical mass always a little later than people think it will. There's always sort of this vague panic about it, but it never happens quite as fast as you think it's going to.
There was a report 5 years ago, some journalism organization came up with a report that said by 2016, basically newspapers will be dead. There just won't be. Maybe there'll be the New York Times and USA Today, but there'll be no newspapers. Well, that hasn't happened, and it's not going to happen right now. And I do think that Diane's right. I think there's people talk about it, and they talked about radio dying too after TV came on, and film dying after TV came on. So there's always that whatever. I think, there's definitely going to be a slimming down. But I'm not quite ready to write the obituary for most big cable. And what Nevin said is also sort of talking about this cobbling, it reflects the reality, which is that right now, at least, to put together any sort of decent package of stuff, you need to spend a lot of money. These services aren't cheap. So there's a lot of talk, but so far, not a lot of action.
Yeah, I think the big question is going to be when finally internet subscription TV is sort of widely available, when you can really sort of subscribe via Apple TV or what have you to a skinny bundle of 12 channels. Then you add on top of that HBO Now, and you add on top of that Hulu and Netflix. Is that enough for people? And then how does that change the ecosystem?
Well, and this relates to, Alan Wurtzel, who's the head of research for NBC, did this great presentation yesterday. And he points out that I think it was over the last 5 years, like people are still only watching about 17 channels regularly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that goes directly to your point of cobbling together, what you watch regularly when you can. But I'm also pretty sure the cable companies are going to fight this tooth and nail.
Well, the traditional MSOs sort of have the most to lose at this point, but they're becoming sort of the gatekeepers of broadband anyway, so they're still
right,
in the
so
game.
They'll find a way to get paid, but you know, one of the biggest, most interesting tidbits I think that's come out in the last, since the start of the year, capping away at TCA, and that was someone at Time Warner basically sort of, there's been talk that maybe Apple could be interested in somehow buying a spun off Time Warner and buying the television assets. Imagine if that happened. Imagine if overnight a Hulu or a Google or an Apple or an Amazon, who have a lot of cash on hand, suddenly said, we're just going to buy off these networks. You don't want to do deals with us. You don't want to give us the rates we want. Well, how about we just buy that? And that would be a total game changer if suddenly, for example, all the Turner networks or all the Viacom networks were suddenly, you know, available for $5 and Apple could just say, well, fine, we'll just skip the ecosystem. We'll buy it. And the other thing that's interesting is there's also been rumors that Netflix could build its own studio, its own physical studio, and sort of cut out some costs that way. So I think a lot of that's going to be interesting to see is if these new media companies that have a big vested interest in being the future of television distribution, if they get frustrated with people not sort of doing deals with them and said, screw it, we'll just buy you out. That could happen.
Yeah, well, you know, it depends on what kind of money they have, but absolutely, there's been question for years on when, you know, Apple might make a big acquisition like that, and you know, a lot of question about what kind of mergers and acquisitions we're going to see this year, and you know, getting deep into the woods or sort of what happens kind of post Sumner Redstone with Viacom and sort of all those properties, and does that sort of trigger a massive realignment this year? Going back to Alan Wurzel real quick, because of course he made waves at the NBC Day at the Television Critics Association press tour, because he unveiled some new information from a tech firm in San Francisco called Symphony, which has been looking to try to get some real ratings out of Netflix. Of course, Netflix famously will never tell us how many people are watching Jessica Jones or Daredevil or Orange is the New Black and all that. But there's been talk for a while of taking audio cues from those shows and basically companies on their own trying to measure who's watching what. And Symphony did that. They took what's called audio content recognition technology, which is basically tech that's on phones that tracks viewership by capturing the soundtrack of these shows. And they've come up with some interesting numbers. For example, Jessica Jones on Netflix, they show from September through December, an average episode averaged about 4.8 million viewers in adults 18 to 49 during a 35-day cycle. Aziz Ansari's show, Master of None, got about 3.9 million. Narcos got about 3.2 million. Those, by the way, pretty good numbers, to tell you the truth.
I was sort of shocked by actually the fact that, you know, that NBC presented these numbers. And I have a lot of – I take issue with how those numbers were presented, and we can get to that later. But it actually showed to me there are a lot of people watching on streaming. And I was actually sort of curious, even though NBC would want to make the point, hey, you can get a lot more viewers through NBC, which is probably true. You know, it was sort of some hard evidence that people actually are watching Netflix shows.
Yeah. And I think what NBC was showing, at least, that, you know, Netflix, as we've all kind of been treating them already, is like a top tier cable network. You know, it's in the game with the FXs and AMCs of the world. I think what NBC was trying to say was, you know, they're just part of another part of the ecosystem, that they're, you know, no bigger behemoth than any other network. They're just part of the game. But nonetheless, it's sort of interesting, and it changes the conversation now, because even if Netflix won't give us numbers going forward, these are numbers now that we can all use and all sort of cite, and it'll be really interesting to see how Netflix kind of responds to that.
Or Joe, do you just not trust these numbers?
It's not a matter, Diane, of whether or not whether I trust the numbers. I mean, first of all, look, I do take big issue with Netflix, with NBC only releasing adults 18 to 49 numbers. Wurzel, yes, in his presentation noted, oh, yes, Netflix doesn't care about that, but, oh, supposedly, you know, this is what the buzz is or they're geared towards. That's respectfully fair, as Alan Wurzel himself would say, okay? Because the fact is Netflix gets just as much money from a 50-year-old subscriber as it does from a 34-year-old subscriber. A 16-year-old subscriber can be just as valuable to Netflix because their parents want to keep them happy, or Netflix is a cheap way to make them happy and maybe get them from stopping to watch video games, or especially an 8-year-old subscriber, even more valuable to get them out of their hair for an hour or two. So first of all, the viewer number should be released. And if they want to go demos, they should probably go 12 to 34, 12 to 24, which is probably where the biggest concentration of Netflix might possibly be. Well, even though I'm not even convinced that makes sense, because my mother has discovered Netflix and streaming, and she just binges like a demon now. now. But I don't know how it does change the conversation, Mike, respectfully. Yes, it can potentially, maybe put a number and sort of try to curb the hype, right? Because Netflix gets a lot of hype. Everyone writes about it because people see things on Twitter and buzz. But, you know, that's been the case for years. Networks have been complaining about that with cable and HBO. Oh, why are you writing about that HBO show, Girls? No one watches Girls, blah, 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 blah. It misses the point. These shows are culturally relevant, and that's what media for at least the last 10 years, and especially in the age of the internet, has been covering, is what's relevant. And the network should spend less time worrying about how many numbers Netflix are getting or trying to prove that Netflix isn't as big as you all think it is, and start working on creating shows that actually are have passionate bases that people really want to watch, that make network relevant to viewers, that makes people, younger viewers especially, come back into that ecosystem that remember, oh, there is such a thing as NBC. You know, NBC's done a great job of stabilizing its schedule with some older skewing shows, and hats off to them. It makes sense for them. They're in the business of advertising, so good for them. But they're also losing a whole generation of 18 to 24-year-old viewers that they used to have with their comedies. You know, once Parks and Recreation left and 30 Rock, they just lost that 18 to 34 audience. And yeah, that's not a good thing. And they need to address that and stop. You know, as much as I deeply respect Alan Wirtz, I think he's really smart, and as much as I think Netflix is often full of crap when they put out their own press releases about stuff, they are. I mean, they put out, or Amazon. Let's face it, right? You guys all saw the press release about Amazon saying, oh, Man in the High Castle is our most streamed show ever. Yes.
Right. Prove it. Give us the numbers.
Show with the biggest ad buy. Yeah. So great. That's fine. And you can put out that press release and I can ignore that press release. So, the new media spin like, spin sugar. Remember that song?
Right. And everyone spins. Well, let's hold on that for now. Let's talk after the break more about what's ahead for the year of 2016 in television.
The future, Mike?
The future. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's The Spinoff.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Hey, we're back. It's The Spinoff. I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine and TVInsider.com. Back again, Joe Adalian of Vulture.com, Diane Gordon of The Surf Report. We're talking TV 2016. And as we mentioned before, the new stat on time shifting is that almost exactly half of TV watching is happening that way now. But there are people who still watch TV the traditional way. We can't forget that.
This gal right here, I do watch some stuff live.
You watch some live TV?
I do.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes it's still the easiest way to do it. And during commercial breaks, you can check your iPad or what have you. Or watch the commercials and support the ecosystem.
Or check my Twitter feed.
I watch reruns of The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson on Nintendo TV Online. And I don't have a DVR on that station, so I have to watch it live. And I don't like commercials anymore, I just got to say, but it's yes, there's still some live viewing going on.
Well, I like that you're contributing to The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson's Live Plus 1,000 ratings.
Or like 10,000.
10,000, I think. Now. You're right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Netflix, so last time we had a show, it was before Making a Murderer. We got to mention Making a Murderer because that was the phenomenon of the holiday season. I don't know a person who I ran into who wasn't watching it or binging it or talking about it. It's still part of the conversation even now. For a month, it seemed like that was about the only thing in the TV world. Is there something that others can learn from that? Broadcast, cable, anyone?
Yeah, there's something big you can learn from that. You don't have to overproduce your shows. That you can do, whether it's a scripted series or an unscripted series, that sometimes less is more. You know, so much of TV these days is about dumbing down and simplifying and adding flashy bells and whistles, especially on the unscripted side. I mean, just look at cable news. And here's a documentary that was just 10 hours, sometimes of the slowest scenes imaginable, of just like long shots in the courtroom or long shots of people making soup in a kitchen. attention, right? And it was utterly engrossing. And I think, you know, there are many levels of lessons you can learn, but for me, one of the biggest lessons, it's not the most obvious one, I think, is that don't take viewers' intelligence for granted, that they can handle a complicated story, that they can get looped in, that you can, you know, and that's partially because of the Netflix format, right? On demand, binge, so you don't have to come back every week and you don't have to be reminded. But I think it made for riveting storytelling and just allowing the story to be told, as opposed to Dateline or 48 Hours, where it's just, you know, the most sensationalistic way of telling a story. And I think that was refreshing. And it shows that viewers are willing to sort of think and to be patient and not the short attention span doesn't have to always be catered to.
And Di, you had some interesting thoughts on social media. And so,
well,
you know,
for me, it was also, for one, it was a brilliant timing strategy on Netflix's mm-hmm. part to drop
yes.
it at the holidays.
Yes.
When people are either bored or would like to be diverted from family activities, maybe they need a getaway.
Yeah, yeah, and watch a documentary about murder.
How to make a murderer.
Yes.
And then what also strikes me is that, you know, is the viewing driving the social media or is it vice versa? Because all of a sudden, you know, your Facebook feed is just flooded with making a murderer and your Twitter feed's flooded with making a murderer. So I, you know, this was the first time where I thought to myself, I'm not sure which is driving which. Usually it's the viewing driving social, but it might have been the reverse this time because you're starting to see, you know, if certain people watch, you go, man, I got to jump on that. I got to get on that. I got to watch that.
Yeah. And I love that the networks are figuring out that, you know, there are certain times a year where you can really go hard with events. And NBC has been kind of out early with that. Of course, a couple years ago, they learned it with Sound of Music Live. This year, they did the Wiz Live. But, you know, even you look at the numbers for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, which gets over 20 million viewers. There are times a year where people are actually still at home sitting in front of the television. And that's when you need to grab them because they're still available. And, you know, Netflix was able to do that in a great way. And then some of the other networks kind of started to figure that out as well. I'm going to be really curious to see what they do next holiday in 2016.
Exactly.
Because there's an opportunity to really throw something out there and hope for that same kind of grassroots explosion.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Diane said about the holiday part of it. And, you know, it's funny. I saw over the holiday, I was looking back through some old TV Guide magazines, Mike, that I saw online, the covers. And there were some shows that premiered like in mid-December back in the day. Networks have done this before. But I think another interesting thing that came out of TCA, too, that's related to this is when David and also an interview I did with David Nevins right before the holidays, in which he basically said to us that, you know, we're not going to roll out our shows, you know, two by two anymore. We're going to sort of try to have a new premiere every month. That's another way Netflix and Amazon and Hulu have changed the equation because they are constantly putting on new stuff. And, you know, Mike, we've been writing for years about, you know, networks going off in the summer. And yeah, networks have found ways to fill the summer with programming, but they're not, for the most part, putting their A-list in the summer, you know, and you still have so many shows being rushed into January. It's like, guys, start spacing it out. Start figuring. I think the biggest thing we're talking about the future now, the biggest challenge I think for networks in the next couple of years is how to stay relevant and how to stay relevant year round to avoid these sort of giant gullies. You know, right now, ABC is in a big gully right now. They do have American Crime that they're trying to hype, but it's not really working too much. It's helping a little bit, but for the most part, they've sort of turned off the lights for the last 3 weeks. Networks need to start like really getting serious about premiering shows every month, every couple of weeks,
Joe,
in the summer.
And Joe, what this also goes to is it's a matter of language because the broadcast networks are not smart enough. They keep calling these, well, it's a summer series. It's this. So, you know, that gets perceived as though we're kind of like a throwaway.
Right.
Like, and they got to scrap that, man. That the language has to change because that changes perception when they put a show out.
Well, strategically, it's going to be really interesting to see what they do come May at the upfronts, how many shows they pick up. I think what the broadcast networks sort of found themselves in this midseason is suddenly they had so much product sitting on the shelves because, as we know, there is more patience this fall. There's already this movement toward sort of keeping shows on the air longer and sort of spacing out these launches more. But as a result, you're seeing the networks scramble to kind of squeeze all these shows on the schedule before the end of the year. There's still a lot of shows that don't even have air dates, like CBS's Person of Interest. And so, you know, they seem to be doing about the same number of pilots this year, but the question is going to be, do they pick up the same number of series as they did last year, or do they do what you're saying, Joe, which is really strategically figure out how to sort of spread these launches out and have the right amount of shows at the right amount of time because they're going to stick with shows and not have to scramble and after they cancel something because you can't do that anymore. where you can't just cancel a show and then quickly shove another show in there. You have to be more strategic. No,
and they're going to need to find cost-effective ways of filling hours of TV if they're going to focus more. You know, there's no reason a network can't do a really interesting documentary series that's not Dateline or that uses the Dateline brand but evolves it. There's no reason they can't really be trying again with variety shows, which I know I sound like a broken record to anyone who listens to this podcast. But, you know, why isn't something like James Corden's show in primetime or a different kind of talk show in primetime? Or how about why aren't more people trying to compete with do what Mad TV did back in the 90s and do a sketch or in Living Color? Why aren't there more sketch comedies? I mean, networks
need because Sketch
to,
all migrated, you know.
Right, Sketch. Well, that's the thing, Diane. Exactly.
To Comedy Central.
Sort of news. Here's the thing. The networks now – because the fact is that was back – that made sense when, you know, there was a time when there was a big difference between network and cable ratings. Well, now if you all look at the ratings, which I know you do, you'll see on – except for the biggest hit shows, there's not a big difference, especially with the L3s, between network and cable ratings for a lot of top-tier shows. I mean, Lip Sync Battle last week scored bigger ratings than American Crime Story even when the L3s came in and a whole bunch of other shows.
So why
aren't networks getting back into those genres they abandoned? They need to get back and they need to experiment and they need to figure out how do we put relevant, fun, interesting programming that gets people talking and gets people coming back into our ecosystem.
And I will defend the broadcast networks. I think they're trying. Because I am old school.
Jane, you ignorant slut.
Yeah, but I will say I can see it in their eyes. I can see what they're starting to do. You know, they are taking more chances. You know, CBS doing more of these shows in the summer. They're trying to get back into reality. ABC doing Madoff as a miniseries, doing American Crime. You know, NBC, all of the interesting live things that they're doing now. You know, Fox, you know, sort of jumping in on that bandwagon too. They're trying. I see them sort of, you know, taking some of these sort of, you know, chances, unique chances, you know, X-Files coming up. But it's not enough. You're right. There needs to be more. Real quick, Stephen Avery, guilty or not? No, we won't touch that. Now we're at the point in the show where
it doesn't matter. That's the question.
Now we're at the point of the show where we'll go around the room and we'll each download the show or story that's top of mind this month. Di, what are you looking forward to?
American Crime Story, The People versus OJ.
Preach it.
Oh, man, FX, they just knocked it out of the park with this one. And I have to say Ryan Murphy, you know, and his crew, they just did a top-notch job with this. The casting, I think, for one, you know, I think most people in the press corps have seen the first six episodes.
Yeah.
Because FX put out those
John
screeners.
Travolta as Robert Shapiro. David Schwimmer
Kardashian.
As Robert Kardashian. Just start there.
And the wonderful Courtney B. Vance.
Yes.
As Johnny Cochran.
Sarah Paulson as Marsha Clark.
Incredibly good.
List goes on.
On and on and on. And it's terrific. You just want it to go on and on and on and on. Everybody who watched the screeners was like, I want more now.
Well, you know, what's funny, I was discussing this with someone the other day, is we all know the story. We all know how it ends. We know the Bronco chase. We know what happened. But yet you watch it and you're like, oh, no. What's going to happen? I forget who I was talking to the other day. But, you know, you see OJ in the back of the Bronco with the gun to his head. And you're like, what's he going to do? Is he going to pull the trigger? Well, no. We know. We know he didn't pull the trigger. We know exactly how it ended.
Exactly.
But you're still in the moment and you're riveted.
And it's really well done and it's just tawdry enough. Not too much so it's cheesy, but it's just tawdry enough.
Mama Mode would disagree. She actually watched the first two and said, it's kind of cheesy, isn't it? But it's good.
I think intentionally. But in a good way. I think in all the good ways.
Yeah.
It's in early February. I think I had February 2, so early February
2nd,
on FX.
It's Mojo birthday.
Yeah, it's Mojo birthday. When are we going to have Mama Mojo on, by the way? That should be a side project. But Joe, what are you thinking about?
Well, you know, there was another show that Netflix dropped, as networks all want to do now, over the holiday break that did not get quite as much attention as Making a Murderer. And I actually watched before Making a Murderer. And it's called F is for Family. And, you know, I'd heard about this show for a while, you know, among the dozens of shows, literally dozens of shows that Netflix has in development. And I didn't think much of it because I just heard the words Bill Burr. And Bill Burr just makes my eyes roll over. Isn't he one of those comics I've never heard of? Whatever. I didn't know.
He's a really good comic.
Yeah. He was on Breaking Bad.
I think for some reason I thought it was part of the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, but I don't think he
is.
But
no. Very different.
That's on me. But anyway, so I didn't know who Bill Burr was. I didn't know what that was about. It just sort of looked weird. Then I watched the first episode. Then I realized it was set in the 1970s, early 70s. And it's an animated comedy that's set in the early 70s. That's a little bit of King of the Hill, a little bit All in the Family, and a whole lot of awesome. It's about a guy just trying to make it in the early 70s, which was a time of, you know, stagflation and gas lines and just it's Donald Trump would have really cleaned up in the early 1970s had he been around. But it's just a really well done meditation on life in the 70s through the point of view of this of a guy who's trying to make it, and his family, his younger family, trying to survive it. And you know, it someone who was born in 1971, it harkens back to the days when parents let their kids, you know, go out and play and nearly kill themselves, and no one really knew, as opposed to now where parents are much more protective. But it's just really well done. It can get a little loud, and there's a lot of yelling involved and cursing, but it's a really well done family show. And I think it's a 3-hour time commitment, if that. There are 6 episodes, half hour, but it's really just a really great show.
And for me, you know, X-Files is coming back, just in case you haven't heard. It's on the cover of the current issue of TV Guide magazine. Pick
the
up
truth
at Stan.
Is still out there.
Keep up on Stan, pick up on Stan's now. But, you know, to me, there's an interesting parallel between, stay with me real quick, between the return of the X-Files and Star Wars, The Force Awakens. Because when you think about it, it's a sort of beloved franchise that's been gone for a while. It's coming back. Almost a whole new generation can now discover it. And what I think we're finding with Star Wars right now is we all saw Star Wars and had a great time, but you're starting to see a lot of people nitpick it. You know, people are, you know,
always
sort of, you know, oh, well, you know, how did Rey, you know, how is she able to handle a lightsaber so fast? And, you know, so the haters are coming out. And yeah, okay, you can nitpick it all day long, but it's a fun ride at the movie theater, and I'm here to say that X-Files, okay, you can nitpick the return all day long if you want to, but if you were a fan of the show and you enjoyed it back in the day, it's fun to see Mulder and Scully back again. It's comforting to have my old friends back, and the aliens are back, and the smoking man is back.
And the monsters.
And, you know, Chris Carter is back.
I want to believe you, Mike, but...
Well, here's the thing, though, with TV shows. People always, you know, they just wanted to, like, change the face of television. Hey, newsflash, every show can't do
that. Well, Diane, X-Files already did that. They did that in 1993.
Yes, they did.
X-Files is not going to come back and change the face again. If anything, it's sort of a throwback now. It's not going to reinvent the form. It's nostalgia, yes, exactly. But it's only coming back for 6 episodes. So revel in the nostalgia. 2 episodes of it are conspiracy episodes. The other 4 are classic Monster of the Week episodes.
One's a comedy episode.
It's just 6 episodes. Enjoy it. I know there's a belt. The critics are not huge fans of the return from what I've seen so far.
Reviews are mixed.
You know, look past the reviews. I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to more episodes. I'm just happy that they're back. You know, just like Star Wars, yeah, you could nitpick it all day long, but move past it and just enjoy the ride for 6 episodes. The fact that our old pals, Mulder and Scully, are back in our lives.
Mike, I think we should continue this discussion in the next podcast once we see what the ratings are, because I have a lot of thoughts. So let's make a day to discuss this again.
All right. Well, there you go. Stay tuned for the next edition of The Spinoff on KCRW.
It's a cliffhanger. This is the first cliffhanger episode.
Exactly.
How will Joe and Mike discuss the X-Files? Tune in tomorrow.
As always, thank you, Joe.
Well, thanks, Mike.
And thank you, Diane.
Always a pleasure.
That's Joe Adalian, the West Coast editor of Vulture.com, and Diane Gordon, creator of The Surf Report. You can follow Joe on Twitter at TV Mojo and Diane at The Surf Report. And I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine and TVInsider.com, and my Twitter handle is at Franklin Avenue. And that's it for this edition of The Spinoff. This podcast is produced by Caitlin Parker. Ray Guarna is our technical director, and additional help today from Kat Yore. You can hear past episodes of The Spinoff on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much everywhere where you can download podcasts. And you can hear it online at kcrw.com and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. And until next time, this is The Spinoff, signing off.